Jesse's Voice of the Cave Drive Time. Going places. Getting there.
91.3. Welcome back to Voice of the Cape Drive Time, coming to you on 91.3 and worldwide. Saif al-Islam, the most prominent son of Libya's slain leader Muammar Gaddafi, has been sentenced to death by a firing squad. He was sentenced in absentia today in Tripoli, along with eight other senior members of the former regime, which was overthrown in 2011. They were accused of war crimes and suppressing peaceful protests during the revolution, a state prosecutor said in early June. Online to discuss this issue with us is Jason Pack, a researcher on Middle Eastern and world history. You can get him at libyaanalysis.com. He's also done extensive commentary for the BBC, Al Jazeera and many media outlets, written a lot about Libya and also spent a lot of time there dealing with Libya. Also online with us is Hanan Salah, MENA researcher, Middle Eastern North Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Hanan, I'm going to start off with you first of all at Human Rights Watch. Your organization has expressed a lot of concern at the trial of Saif al-Islam and two prime ministers of Muammar Gaddafi and his intelligence officer or security officer. First of all, what were the grounds for Human Rights Watch to express concern about the trial of some of the more prominent Gaddafi people?
Well, thank you for having me on your show. First and foremost, of course, we consider this to be a missed opportunity or a missed chance to deliver justice in the post-Gaddafi era. We've been following, the cases of these former Gaddafi officials. We have visited them on multiple occasions. We are in touch with the lawyers, with the families. We have attended some of the trial sessions, and obviously we have, been tracking this issue for a long time. What we see today is really a process that was undermined by very serious due process violations. Violations that, we have been warning against from a while ago, especially the access of the defendants and many of the defendants who got, or most of the defendants who got, who got the death penalty today. Had limited access to their lawyers, if they had lawyers at all. I think that would be, one of the major issues that we had. There were allegations of ill treatment on behalf of some of these same detainees. Some access to the court documents was limited on behalf of the lawyers and on behalf of the defendants, meaning that the lawyers and the defendants were, very often not able to prepare themselves ahead of sessions or even ahead of the final, appealing. And I think, the one cornerstone really of a fair trial is that you're able to meet in confidentiality and in private with your lawyer to discuss your case. And we are really dismayed to know that, none of those who are considered to be some of the more senior officials of Gaddafi were able to meet with their lawyers in private. And there are other issues such as lack of witnesses who were called, for instance.
Jason Pack, you've drunk Libyan coffee. You've been to Libya. It's your area of expertise. Would you agree with Human Rights Watch perspective on these trials that in a sense that they all were, in fact, a missed opportunity?
I think they're a missed opportunity, but for a very different reason. Hanan has pointed out some crucial things from a technical and legal perspective as to why these trials are illegitimate. And that's, of course, the case. They're a miscarriage of justice, but there was never going to be any justice. There's no state. There's no, independent judiciary in Libya. So that's all not surprising. And I would say it's not what's fundamentally important. What's fundamentally important is the politics. We've been moving towards a deal between the Tobruk faction and the Tripoli faction. And yet, this is an attempt by spoilers inside Tripoli to put their thumb in the eye of some of the former Gaddafi supporters who were willing to sign up and make peace. Yes, of course the guys who are being sentenced are guilty. I mean, Abu Zayd Dorda, Baghdadi al-Mahmoudi, these are the worst goons of the old regime. They're guilty. But this is not the right time for this when we're trying to have a reconciliation between the two camps. So That's the context that I would look at this in terms of a missed opportunity. It's a missed opportunity to command a kind of compromise solution between the one faction, the Tobruk Zintan faction, who's more aligned with these former Gaddafi officials, and the other faction, the Tripoli faction, who opposes them and is aligned with the Islamists. Hope that's clear.
Indeed. I'm going to get back to you, Hanan. Obviously, Human Rights Watch, you know, your lens is purely from the human rights aspect. Would you concede that the political climate surrounding the trials has perhaps clouded them, and that is probably the unfortunate dimension?
Well, let me tell you something. I've been drinking Libyan coffee for the past 4 years, so I think that the way that we look at this is very much within the context of what is going on in Libya. We're not looking at this trial as a detached event that is happening and that just started a month ago or a year ago. We're looking at it very much within the context. And as we said, and we were very clear in our statement, we are hugely concerned about the situation on the ground in Libya. Of course, our main concern is the delivery of justice and the fair trial aspects. We are slightly less concerned with what's going on in detail in whatever peace process. But we are very concerned if people are being sentenced to death. If 9 people are sentenced to death, 8 people get life sentences. And then, a host of others get, all sorts of different sentences, without getting a fair shot at having a fair trial, without being able to defend themselves. What our main concern with regards to the institutions and the situation on the ground in Libya is that we do have, in fact, two authorities. We have an internationally recognized government in eastern Libya that is totally rejecting the verdict, that is saying that, it's calling upon the world to not be accepting this verdict because they consider the government in Tripoli to be illegitimate. On the other hand, there is a self-declared authority in Tripoli that, took over this trial from a former government and is now continuing with this trial and has been pushing to pass on some of these sentences. The really concerning thing here is that Libya's judiciary at a national level is in a state of near collapse. I went to eastern Libya, to Benghazi. I was in Tripoli earlier this year as well, and we have, documented really the lack of any functioning courts, or most courts are actually, not functional in all parts of Libya. The situation in the south is even worse. It's totally paralyzed in the south. There's threats against judges, lawyers, prosecutors, all the time, which make it very difficult, obviously, to operate. And that also raises questions, of course, whether the lawyer, the judges, and the prosecutors can be fully independent and can reach a fully independent decision. The other issue is with regard to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, which is supposed to be the national last arbiter, is based in Tripoli. However, given the situation on the ground, it is also questionable to us if the current setup of a Supreme Court will be able to afford a remedy for these verdicts.
Jason, from your perspective, are these decisions that have been made, are they reversible? The first question might be a stupid question, but number two, what effect do you think this decision is ultimately going to have? You've already alluded to it, but what do you think is going to be the end product in terms of trying to get Libya united?
Well, I'll have to concede, Hanan has probably had more Libyan coffee than I have. Certainly in the last years, I had it a lot earlier, and I think that her perspective is a kind of what's in it in the judiciary and a kind of narrow, Libya plus human rights perspective. I want us to go up to 30,000 feet and see that there are no institutions that function in Libya. Rather than having two governments, an internationally recognized one in Tobruk and a non-internationally recognized one in Tripoli, there's actually no governments, there's no sovereignty, there's no institutions. Every day there are miscarriages of justice in Libya as the militias are randomly killing people. This is a minor blip when it comes to human suffering or, miscarriage of justice. That's happening every day in Libya. The important aspect is the politics, right? And you say, are they reversible? Well, The problem with the death penalty is that once you carry it out, it's not reversible. So for the people who are in custody in Tripoli, and I believe that's Abdi Dorda and Baghdadi Mahmoudi and some other, you know, unsavory characters, if they actually get executed, it's not reversible. For Saif, because he's controlled by the Zintan militia, which does not answer to the Tripoli or Libya Dawn faction, it's very reversible. And I consider this a negotiating position on behalf of some hardline elements within the Libya Dawn, or what's sometimes referred to as the Steadfast Front. But the problem is it's not a good negotiating position. And using someone who you have under trial, giving him a death sentence as a negotiating position in larger negotiations is not only unfair and a miscarriage of justice and all the things that we've heard about from Hanan, which are completely true, but it runs the risk of being yet another spoiling, derailing element in the larger attempts to come up to some solution where we can have a unity government and begin to build institutions. And that's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take months and months and months even to negotiate the annexes to the agreement and to potentially move forward and create some kind of unity institutions. But this is a setback.
Hanan, would you agree that the situation in Libya is a dire one? And perhaps to try and get another perspective, that this recent court case is maybe the symptom of a greater malaise?
Yes, I absolutely would agree that the situation is dire. And, you know, my view of things is, you know, not as rosy with regards to what a potential government of national unity could achieve today. Given that, you know, not all factions seem to be on board. In fact, you know, a major faction seems to not be on board. And then, you know, the bigger question, how would that ever be implemented on the ground, given that none of the commanders on the ground that I have met on both sides have ever shown any interest in any kind of power sharing. I think that, you know, with regards to the reversible question that you pose, it's a very, very important question. There are things that still can be done, and, you know, we've actively called for one of them. The Supreme Court, you know, is still able to do an independent review, and, you know, we would hope that this review would be a review based on fact and law, so not just a review based on the procedures and whether there were any procedural flaws, but, you know, to check the facts and to see if, you know, the facts were fulfilled before passing on the judgment. And, of course, you know, our other call is for the Supreme Court to suspend these death sentences regardless.
Jason, to get back to you, perhaps one of the causes of what we're discussing is the absolute fracturing of Libyan society after 2011, Benghazi being separate to Tripoli and Tobruk being separate to Tripoli now, etc., etc. How do we understand this? I think a lot of people listening to us right now are scratching their heads and wondering and asking themselves very quickly, why did Libya break up into so many different factions after 2011? Is there an easy, logical answer to this question?
I think that there is an easy but illogical answer, because this is not about rationality. Briefly put, Libya has never functioned as a unified state. You know, in the trade, we call it a stateless state. The Italian colonialism from 1911 to 1942 was a rape and pillage one that destroyed indigenous institutions and uprooted indigenous society. The British governed Libya as two separate entities, plus the French in the south. They cobbled it together very quickly after a UN decision in 1949. And the Senussi monarchy was itself a weak monarchy that got catapulted into the modern age when it hit oil wealth. And there have never been proper centralized institutions in Libya. It's not like Egypt or Tunisia in that way. It's not a organic or authentic nationalism. And all of that has been bubbling under the surface of the Gaddafi regime, which was a brutal dictatorship that never built institutions. So it's no surprise to anyone in this game that when the lid was removed from the pot under Gaddafi, that there were not going to be all of a sudden a building of a coherent state. Of course not, because there are regional identities and local patriotisms and a lack of institutions and qualified personnel and all that, plus tremendous pots of money because of the oil wealth of Libya, you know? And that fueled the competition. We've seen this in many other states whereby oil wealth is a curse. It's not a blessing because it pits factions against each other who attempt to control the state, to seize the wealth. And, you know, Libya has been a petri dish for all of these forces playing out since 2011.
Hanan, our final question from the viewpoint of Human Rights Watch. It must be hugely frustrating when you are parachuted, as it were, into a country like Libya that just simply implodes and explodes after a revolution in the way that it has.
I mean, it certainly is. I think that the work, I mean, it's also come as no surprise that the work that, you know, we have been doing and we have been trying to do has changed dramatically from the time that I was able to, you know, I was based in Tripoli until July 2014, 3 days before the war broke out, and I had to leave like everybody else because it just became impossible for us to operate on the ground. But, I mean, again, I think the important thing here is that we're looking at it from a perspective of a much longer period. Of a much longer period of time. And, you know, if you look at this trial, for instance, this, you know, as I said before, this did not start before yesterday. You know, the arrests of some of these officials were in September 2011, in the immediate aftermath of this revolution. I think that, you know, this also signifies, or is something of, you know, it signifies a certain stage where the country is at. And yes, the disappointment, of course, is huge, but I wouldn't only say, I'd probably disagree a little bit with your guest when you know, Jason says it's a minor blip. This is the trial that has been that we're all attention of the general prosecutor's office in Tripoli has been, you know, shifted on this trial. There's so much at stake here. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, you know, Gaddafi's son, is wanted by the International Criminal Court. Libya is currently in violation of an international court decision, of the International Criminal Court decision, which says that it must hand over Saif al-Islam Gaddafi to The Hague. So there are, you know, much bigger issues that are with that. And with that comes a sort of an apathy, let's say, at the, you know, from the international community, especially from the Security Council. For the past 4 years, we haven't seen a single measure of punishment or sanction in Libya, which, you know, I think has you know, contributed to a large extent to this deterioration. So nobody punished Libya for really obstructing the work of the International Criminal Court and for refusing to hand over Saif al-Islam when it was probably still possible. And to date, the Security Council has also not, you know, punished any of those responsible for serious human rights violations, even though there is quite a strong sanctions regime in place.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. We've been discussing the fact that Saif al-Islam, Muammar Gaddafi's most famous son, has been sentenced to death by firing squad, as have other leaders of the Gaddafi regime. This has happened in Tripoli. Our special guest, Jason Pack, a researcher on Middle Eastern world history. You can get all of Jason Pack's work at libyaanalysis.com. He's also been a commentator for BBC Al Jazeera, amongst many others. Also, Hanan Salah, a Middle East and North African researcher at Human Rights Watch. Both of you, thank you so much for your time. We could have carried on discussing this issue much longer. I think we need to discuss it for much longer, but unfortunately we have to leave it right now. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Thank you.